history theory is actually important. Now, as everyone knows, as it stands, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory is an instrumentalist interpretation in the sense that any values of quantities can only be given a posteriori, therefore after measurement. What this means is that it implies a division between observed system and observer. Obviously, such an interpretation is not possible in the case of closed quantum systems, for example, quantum cosmology. And an attempt to be able to define quantum theory even for closed systems is precisely history theory. Sorry, that should just be history theory, not consistent history theory. Okay, there are various types of history formulation.
One you said.
It's a bit. Okay, so this is a mistake. Okay, so the various formulation of history theory, one of which is consistent histories. And the most popular one is the one from Oms, Griffin, Skelman, and Hartle, in which they identify a history, which is just a sequence of events at different times, with the products of projection operators. And as such, they're not actually projection operators. Now, another formulation of history theory, which I will actually focus on, is the HPO formalism of consistent histories. Now, a consistent history formulation of quantum theory is a formulation in which we have the notion of a consistent set, which is a set of histories that do not interfere with each other. So you can kind of interpret them as a classical histories. And within each consistent set, then you can apply the normal concept of probabilities. Now, the HPO formalism of consistent histories has two main properties. The first is that all the histories can be identified with projection operators on some Hilbert space. And the second property is that endows the set of all histories with a quantum temporal logic. What I'll describe in this talk is a topos formulation of the temporal logic aspect of this HPO formalism. I say the temporal logical part because, as you will see in the talk, by toposifying, so to say, this HPO formalism, you don't require any more the notion of consistency. And this, in a way, is important, since a problem in consistent histories was how to deal with incompatible consistent sets. But by defining a topos version of it, you kind of solve from the outset this problem in the sense that you will not require any notions of consistency. Oh, history projection operator. Sorry. Okay, then why did I choose the HPO formalism? In recent works by Isham and Doring, they managed to reformulate quantum theory using topos theory. And I'll explain a bit how they do that. But the main ingredient that they use is the existence of a map from projection operators to certain objects of a topos. And in order to apply the formulas that they defined to a context of consistent histories, I had to pick a history formalism in which the projection operators played an important role. And that's why I chose the HPO formalism. So essentially what I'll describe in this talk is, so to speak, a time extension of the topos formulation of quantum theory that Isham and Doring put forward in terms of topos theory. Okay, now, since topos theory is not the most popular...
One view that the history is a projection operator, or can this accommodate some more general idea of history than just projection operator? Because after all, in the path integral, the idea of history is a trajectory or a space-time or something.
In order to really apply the topos machinery, you have to identify them as projection operators. Then It is true that history, I mean, even in consistent history, there are path integrals. But the representation has to be as projection operators to really define them as objects and topos. Even because, I mean, so far there is no concept of integral and a topos. Okay, so what is a topos? A topos is a special type of category. Now, category is a collection of objects and of arrows between these objects. And the arrows normally identify relations between these objects. So, for example, in sets, that's a very, very simple example of a category. But, I mean, a more general could be like the set of all vector spaces that forms a category with linear maps that forms the maps in the category. Or the set of all groups is a category where the maps are group homomorphisms. Or a very simple one is just a poset where the arrows define partial ordering. So this is all you really need to know. I mean, a category is much more complicated, but that's the essential ingredients that you need to know. Now, a topos is a special type of category since it's it looks like sets. When I say it looks like sets, it means that any mathematical construct that can be done in sets can actually be reproduced in a topos. And the important one is the concept of subobject classifier. Now, in sets, a subobject classifier is simply the characteristic functions. So it identifies subobjects. However, it has a topos analog. So if you have an object A, which is a subobject of a Birka object X, a subobject classifier, which you denote with omega, identifies this subobject through a map. Which in sets is just a characteristic function. So it just says that it is true that this subobject is an object of X. However, this can be generalized to any topos. And essentially, what a subobject does, it identifies.
You're talking about subsets here, or what? A is a set, right? And X is a set.
If you're in set theory, yeah, but if you're in a general topos, a general category, it's just a subobject. But in set, yeah, this is a subset, and this then will just be your characteristic functions in set. But this generalizes even if these objects are not sets, but they are objects in a topos. And in that case, you don't just have true or false, but you have more truth values in a general topos. In sets, you just have, in a set, this would just be this, have zero.
So in topos, is it always the sets of truth value is could be infinite, or is it finite, or is it continuous? What is the possibility?
It depends on what topos you consider. It's not infinite, it's finite. It has a lower and upper bound of 0, 1. You can always regain 0, 1. But in between, you have a finite number. But it really depends on what topos you consider.
But it's finite. It's good.
So what the subobject classifier does, it identifies subobjects of X in terms of arrows from X to your subobject classifier. The kind of abstract definition of a characteristic function. Now, another important aspect of topos theory is that the collection of all subobjects form an algebra, which is a Hayton algebra, and is like the collection of all subsets in a set form a Boolean logic, in the same way the collection of all subobjects in a topos forms a Hayton algebra. And a Hayton algebra is a generalized version of a Boolean algebra in the sense that all the operations that you can do in a Boolean algebra, so intersection, union, you can also do it in a Hayton algebra. However, the law of excluded middle does not hold. So for example, if you have the collection of all open sets in a topological space, that is a Hayton algebra. So you know that two open sets, the union is an open set, the intersection is an open set. But if you get the negation of an open set, you have to take the, you cannot take the complement of the open set because it's closed. So you need to take the interior of the complement, which means then if you have an open set and you take the union with the negation, which is now defined as the interior of the complement, you don't get unity. You get unity minus the boundary of the complement. So this is a well-defined mathematics, although it means that you cannot do proofs by contradiction. So your proofs have to be constructive proofs. But it's established functional mathematics. Okay, another question is Weiltauber's theory. Now, as I said at the start, an aim of redefining quantum theory, one of the aims, is to render this theory more realist, so to account for closed systems, for example. And one of the main theorems that states that quantum theory is non-realist is the so-called Cauchy-Speckler theorem, which in words says that you cannot assign truth values, or better saying, you cannot assign quantities to all values at the same time. So in that sense, it's not realist. However, Isham, Butterfield, and Doring showed that it is possible to redefine quantum theory using topos theory such that quantum theory is a bit more realist. And in order to understand why this can be done through topos theory, we need to understand the actual strategy they use to make quantum theory slightly realist, more realist. And the strategy they use is quite simple. So they think, okay, what are the mathematical constructs that make a theory realist? And in order to figure this mathematical construct, they take the realist theory, which is classical theory. And they try and define which are the underpinning mathematical constructs which are present in classical theory and which make the theory realist. If you're able to do that, and if you're able to reproduce this mathematical construct in the context of quantum theory, then you have a chance to make quantum theory realist. Now, classical physics uses sets as the mathematical language. And I've said that topos theory looks like sets. So anything that you can do in sets, you can do in topos theory. So by redefining quantum mechanics in terms of topos theory, you have a chance to redefine all those mathematical constructs that render classical theory realist. I'm sure, but okay, this is what I say here. So because to make quantum theory look like classical physics, you need to reproduce everything that makes classical physics realist using topos theory in quantum theory. And moreover, the logic that you obtain by using topos theory is a Hayton algebra, which is a distributed logic, and is the analog of the Boolean logic that you would obtain in classical physics. So basically, they try and mimic the fundamental mathematical structures using topos theory in quantum mechanics, which will make quantum mechanics look like classical physics.
So are you making the statement here that if you use sets and Boolean logic, then you are necessarily doing classical mechanics?
Well, by class, well, a realist. Well, in classical physics, you use sets.
Hmm? Yeah, but does it mean that there's no other way to use sets for that?
Oh, no. All I'm saying is that, okay, by realist here, I mean a theory that at any point in that one undergoes Boolean logic, and two, you can always define truth values to propositions. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by realist theory. And that's what happens in classical physics. And because you use sets, you actually have truth false. So you can always assign truth values, and you do not have the law excluded middle. That's why you get Boolean logic. And you can compose things in a realist way. And that is what you try to mimic in quantum mechanics using topos theory. I mean, but, yeah. But. Mm-hmm. Okay, now the question is which topos to use. Now, I said that the Cauchon-Sperka theorem said that you cannot assign to all quantities their value at the same time. However, for abelian commuting subalgebras of the algebras of all boundary operators in the Hilbert space, you can actually assign truth values. I mean, commuting quantities, you know that you can assign truth values to them. So what this means is that these Boolean subalgebras can be interpreted as some classical snapshots for which, for those algebras, you can actually assign truth values. So the idea is that if you want to render quantum theory more realist, you have to define it in such a way that is context dependent, so that all the quantities that you want to define, you define for each of these classical snapshots. So it seems a bit like cheating, as you say, if you want to make the quantum theory look more realist, so you kind of localize it to classical snapshots. However, the collection of all these classical snapshots forms a category, which means that any point in time, you can always relate any of this context, I call them context or classical snapshots, which means that although you define, as we'll see, although we'll define our quantities locally, you never lose the global picture precisely because they form a category. So at any point in time, you can relate them. And the category they form is actually a process, so the arrows, the relation between the various classical snapshots, is given in terms of subset inclusion. That's just a simple example to say that any point in time you can relate context. Okay, now the topos that takes into account contextuality is the topos of presheaves over this category of abelian algebras. Now, I'll explain what the symbol.
Could you to make it a little bit more concrete, abelian subalgebra is associated to what, to a region in space-time, and to only, or
no, just a collection of bounded operators which commute.
Okay.
I mean, the B of H is the last rule of the algebra, all bounded operators, mm-hmm. but some certain subset are the ones that commute. Okay, now that's a general definition, but I think it's better if I draw a picture. You have your category. Okay, that called it C, but it doesn't matter. I mean, you have your category of abelian algebras. And the presheaf assigns to each of these elements or context of the category a set. Now, which set it assigns, it depends on which presheaf they're talking about. But it does assign a set. And the assignment of the sets is such that the relation between the various elements of the category is conserved. Although the arrows go the other way around, but you see, it maps, the relations are mapped to relation between the respective sets in such a way that composition, for example, is preserved. So if you go from V4 to V2 to V3, then this presheaf maps this composite arrow to this composite arrow here. So it's just basic assignment to your category of sets for each element in your category such that all the information about the category is conserved in the sets.
The arrows for the sets, is it just the inclusion or?
It depends on what topos you talk about. For example, okay, in the topos that I'll talk about, because it depends what sets associated to them. It could be or could not be.
Is it the same thing as a functor?
Oh, yeah, okay. This is a contrarian functor. Sorry, I should have wrote that. Okay, now that described what was topos is and the topos that we're going to use. I'll briefly describe what Ashim and Dorin did in their papers, namely what are those mathematical constructs which render classical physics realist and which they defined in terms of the tops of the sheaves. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll just talk about the those mathematical objects that I will need to define a history version, a topos version of history theory. So now the first thing is the state space. Now in classical physics, a state space is defined such that any quantity can be represented from the state space to the real, such that you assign the value of that quantity. In standard quantum theory, the state space is just a Hilbert space, and a physical quantity is just a map of the Hilbert space. However, the aim is to reproduce in a topos theoretical manner this kind of relation. And this can be done if the state space is now identified with the spectral presheaf. What the spectral presheaf is basically an assignment to each of these algebras with their spectral. So, or commutative, or simultaneous eigenvalues. So to each of this algebra, it associates the set of all simultaneous eigenvalues of this algebra, and it does it for all of them. And given this construction, then there is this is a mathematical construction called the Gelfand transform that actually tells you that within this, given the spectral presheaf, it is actually possible to associate to a quantity or to an operator. It is possible to represent an operator as a function from the spectrum of the algebra to which the operator belongs to the reals. So what this is telling you is that if you have an operator here, then you know that to this context you associate the spectrum, which contains also the value of this operator. And then there exists a map from the spectrum to the real that actually singles out the value of A. So by defining locally the state space in terms of this presheaf, which is context dependent, you can retrieve this picture so that in this framework, even in quantum theory, you can define physical quantities as maps from the state space to the reals.
So I take one operator, okay, pick one operator here, and then here I have all the commuting sets of operators with this partial order structure. Okay. The operator is a subset of some of those. It lives in some of those, and others it does not live. The ones that it lives defines a map from the spectrum up here to the reals. The one that it, where they don't live, you say something like there is also a map from the spectrum to the reals which goes to zero or something.
This looks good because the ones that they don't live, you can approximate it, as I'm going to say that later, but you can approximate it from above so that you pick in this context the smallest projection which is implied by A. And to that you then you do the same. So you given any projection, you can always approximate it by the smallest which is implied by it, and then you get that. This is to keep contextuality.
The smallest that approximates. So what if these are I have a space of projection operators into position for one particle. Then I have the momentum operator. What's the smallest setups? The smallest thing that approximates it is nothing.
It could even be.
Okay, and then it's trivial. So there are trivial cases where it's just a zero map.
Yeah.
I see.
Okay.
So the sense in which it's realist is if you say, I'm not asking questions about the truth value of the spectrum of this operator, I'm asking something different, which is this operator has a representative in every one of these.
How closest you can get.
Families of consistent, it has a representative quote as close as you can get and there are truth values about those spectra. And is it necessary that those truth values live in a hiding algebra and not a Boolean algebra? Then is that tie the whole thing together?
It does, because I mean, this is how you represent propositions. I mean, in a topos, the propositions, I'll say it later, you can represent it as subobjects of this spectrum, and they automatically follow Hayton algebra. I mean, as soon as you have topos theory, which is not said, you just have Hayton algebra. Proposition. Okay, now another classicality to mimic, so to say, is the concept of a proposition. In classical physics, a proposition like this is given in terms of all those states in the state space for which the proposition is true. So it's a subset of the state space. In quantum theory, a proposition is given by a projection operator. Now we want to mimic, again, this construct in topos physics. So we want to define a proposition as a sub-object of the spectral Brachier. Now, we know that an operator, a projection operator, P say, we know that has values 0, 1. So if P belong to the category V1 or V2, then it would single out a subset of the spectra given by the 0, 1 values. And this for all the projection in all categories. However, not all, if you want to represent the proposition given by the projection P, it is not the case that it belongs to all the algebras. So you have to approximate it. And I'll say mathematically in a bit how you approximate it. And once you approximate it, that for each context, that projection operator will belong to that context and is now the approximate projection operator, which will single out a subset of the spectrum of the algebra. So in other words, for each context V, you obtain a map from your proposition to the subset, a subset of the spectrum of that context. I think I'll say that on the other side. Now, the way in which for each projection operator you approximate it for each context is through the process of dozenization, which is what I was saying before. Basically, you just get, for each context V, you get the smallest projection operator, which is implied by a rigid one. Obviously, if P is in, say, you want to approximate to V2, if P is in V2, then you just get P. But if P is not in V2, then you take the smallest projection operator, which is implied by P.
Is it always unique? Or can it be some degeneracy?
No, like sometimes it's just a unit operator.
No, but it can be two or three.
Because it's the intersection, you see, from the definition, it's the intersection. Okay.
Did you define implies for us?
Excuse me?
Did you define implication? Because you said the rule is you take the smallest projector that's implied by this projector. You just mean that it's subspace, it projects onto a subspace of the other one.
Okay, then if you do that for all contexts, then, I'm not going to show this, but you can show that this map from a projection operator to the approximate projection operator, which then translates to a subset of the spectra of the algebra, actually gives you a map from the projection operator to the subobjects of the spectral pursuits. So through this way, you're able to identify a proposition with subobjects of your state space, and therefore they undergo Hayton algebras because they are subobjects in a topos. Now, the other quantity is a state space, is a state. In principle, this is just a point. Now, in the context of topos theory, however, state space has no points. And the reason is that a point in category language is given by a map from the singleton to a set. So because the only domain is a point, so it singles out a point. Now, in terms of presheaves, a singleton is something like this. And then we have our spectral presheaf. Or the spectrum of the algebra. And the point is a map from here to here. So what the point does is that for each context, it picks out an element of the spectrum of that algebra. Now, if you were able to do this for all contexts, it would mean that you would have value for all quantities even belonging to non-commutative algebras. And this is precisely what you can't do because of the Cauchy-Specker theorem. So a mathematical way of talking about the Cauchy-Specker theorem is saying that the state space has no points. Because if it had, you could assign quantities to each of the values through this map. So what you do, so you can't identify the state with a point, but you identify with something that's the closest you can get to a point.
It's not the case that you can't single out a value for each one of the different contexts. Like what the Cauchy-Specker theorem tells you is that you can't do it in such a way that if a projector appears in two of those contexts, it'll get the same value in both of those. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of the meshing of these different value assignments among the different points. That's what fails. Would you agree?
And I thought that the Cauchy-Specker theorem said that you cannot assign, you cannot define this evaluation map from your bounded operators to the real such that certain properties are satisfied. Not to 0, 1.
I'm sorry, I lost the notation, but I suspect that this consistency that you're talking about is built into the definition of the functor being the statement that this. The statement that you have a functor, so if the same projector appears in two different contexts, then it must be assigned the same value mm-hmm. in both contexts. That's the thing at issue, right?
So where is that built in?
If you mean that you have Q1 in here and then Q1 even in here.
Yep.
Well, then this would assign, P1 belongs to the context before, so this evaluation would map the value of P1 to the spectrum of the algebra before, and it would pick out the same value if this P1 is here as well. It's an assignment. And the assignment is such that any relation between these two is preserved if there's a relation.
Okay, thanks.
So it's the closest you can get to a point. And for each context, then you just get the smallest projection operator, which is implied by the specified operator. Okay, then the second is truth values.
Can you repeat that was the key somehow? The key. Yeah. Just repeat the last sentence.
So you don't have points, so you can define the smallest subobject of the spectral presheaf, which approximates a point, in the sense that for each context, you get the smallest projection operator, which approximates the projection operator associated to your state.
So you've started with a state.
Yeah.
You started with a mixed state, maybe.
Yeah, you have a state psi.
And from that, you get this generalized point.
Yes.
whatever you call it.
Yeah, for each state psi, you have a subobject such that this is true for each complex. But yeah, it depends on the psi.
And is the most general thing coming from a state, from a state vector? I mean, is there some class of generalized state, generalized points? What do you call the generalized points? Or do they have a name? This
No, this is, it's not really generalized, it's the smallest which approximates. I mean, you could have others that are bigger, it's just the smallest. I mean, it's not, yeah, I guess you could call it generalized point, but it's the, in the sense that it is the smallest.
But I guess I'm asking, is there a notion of what these kind of objects are? And then you could prove that every one of them comes from a pure state in the vector and Hilbert space, or is it just sort of a definition that you only consider those that...
I think actually Andreas proved that this is a minimal object given the state and it's unique. Given the state, yeah. I don't quite know that. I think he proved it, I don't really know how he... Okay, then truth values. In classical physics, a truth, a proposition is true given a state S if S belongs to the subobject which represents the proposition. So if you have a proposition, this is your proposition, then if S belongs to the proposition, then that proposition is true given S is the state, which can be written in terms of subset inclusion. Now you want to mimic this in terms of topos theory, and you know that both these objects are subobjects of the spectral Prochief. So you can actually mimic this inclusion relation in terms of subobjects, where this is your analog of a state and this is your proposition. However, everything is defined for each context. So this relation becomes this implication ordering between the two projections which represent the state and the proposition. If this relation holds for all contexts, then you say that that proposition is totally true, like classically true. If it never holds, then the proposition is totally false. However, it could hold in some places, but not in others. And this is where you get the concept of partial truth values. So given this proposition, you identify for a given context its truth values in terms of all the subcontexts for which that proposition is actually true. So you could say how much you have to change your context for that proposition to be true. And this object is a sieve, so it's a well-defined mathematical object. And I mean, the general definition of a sieve is a bit complicated to say, but for, since here the category of commuting algebra is a poset, a sieve is just a downwards closed set. So in this case, it's relatively. Now, the collection of sieves forms a Hating algebra for one context. If you consider all contexts, it defines a global element, and the set of all global elements is a Hating algebra. So on the one side, we have propositions which undergo Hating algebra, and on the other side we have truth values which undergo Hating algebras, which means that the valuation map is actually, which is state dependent, is actually well defined. Okay, now I want to extend all this to the history formalism. So I picked the HPO formalism because, as I said, all the proposition can be written as projection operators in this extended Hilbert space. You can write both homogeneous and inhomogeneous proposition. Now this tensor product, because you define in terms of tensor product, this object is still a projection operator. Now this tensor product has to be interpreted as and then, which means that the HPO formalism actually undergoes a temporal logic. So a temporal logic is just a logic in which you have temporal connectives like this and then. You have all the normal connectives, but you also have temporal connectives. Okay, so the aim is to identify topos representation for this history proposition. Now, all I've said, from what I've said so far, we know that for each time, you can actually identify a proposition as an element of this Haitian algebra. So we have a collection of elements of different Haitian algebras, and we somehow have to group them together so that you get a temporal structure. And this can actually be done through the tensor product Haitian algebra. So I defined the tensor product of Haitian algebra, and this itself is actually a Haitian algebra. And because of that, you can define both homogeneous and inhomogeneous histories as elements of this Haitian algebra. So homogeneous is just a simple tensor product projection operators.
One for each time.
Yeah. And inhomogeneous can be either given as the negation of a homogeneous one or as the or of two homogeneous ones.
So if we try to take a sort of simplest possible example of something like this, would it be like saying you have a bunch of slits at different times or different the particle goes to slit one at time one and slit three at time two, and that's homogeneous. But if you say, well, it either did that or it went through slit three at time one and slit two at time two and so on. So it's basically a collection.
Yes.
Then it's an inhomogeneous history.
And then the negation you can also write as an homogeneous history.
Because if you say it didn't go through this slit at this time, that's equivalent to say, well, it did go through this slit,
yeah,
or this slit, or this slit.
Yeah. All right, so just briefly, this is the definition of a tensor product of Haitian algebras. So you just tensor all the elements such that this property is satisfied. And you can see that the tensor product of Haitian algebra encapsulates the temporal structure of a proposition. Because, I mean, if this has to always be interpreted as and then, you can see that this is equal to that. But if this and then was just be an and, then this two would be equal. But they're not, because it's as a temporal proposition.
Is there something?
Okay.
Is there something for, like, not for the, or, I mean, the negation of the tensor product behaves?
Yeah, you define it. Well, in the Haitian algebra, the negation is given as a pseudo complement. So, the negation.
Or implication, if that's easy.
Okay, the implication then, for example, if A then B, you define it as all the elements such that A and C imply B. I don't know if I remember the definition.
So once you've defined and
yeah, okay.
And then everything follows. Is that the same?
Yeah.
So it's enough to know just.
Yes.
But isn't there some axioms on it that they have to obey? You're saying that's automatically still satisfied when you take the tensor product this way? I mean, you can't just define any notions of and say that it's a Haitian algebra. There's some properties that it has to have.
Okay, this is a Haitian algebra, and this is a Haitian algebra.
Right, so are you guaranteed, but you're just telling us that you're guaranteed when you define the tensor product this way that it's also a Haitian algebra.
Yeah, this is just a definition. As long as, if you define it like that, then all the properties of the Haitian algebra are satisfied.
Are satisfied.
Yeah. Okay, so what we've done is that we've managed to identify the history proposition as an element of the tensor product of two different Haitian algebras at different times. So mathematically, this quantity is actually well defined. However, because we're defining it at different times, this objects actually belong to different topoi. And they don't, I mean, as it stands, they don't actually talk to each other. I mean, they're two topoi at different times, which don't talk to each other. So even though mathematically that is a Hayton algebra, it does not belong to any topos. And this is important, because once it belongs to a topos, you can actually do physics with it. So you need to somehow relate that Hayton algebra to a topos. And in order to do so, you somehow have to make the two individual time topoi talk to each other. And this you can do through something I call the intermediate topos, which is this topos, where the context scattering out the cross product. And in order to see how this topoi is related to the single time topoi, you first understand how the complex categories are related. And that's easy, since the cross product, you know that the cross product is a projection map. And now you also know that the topos of Prosheaves is just a collection of maps from this context scattered to sets, imaginary sets. So through this map, you can pull back all these maps from here to sets. You pull them back from maps to this context scattered to sets. And this is what I do here. So by doing that, you pull back the two topoi to a common ground where they can actually talk. And in this common ground, you can compose all the elements of the different time topoi. And in particular, you can compose the two time state spaces. So then now in this intermediate topos, you actually get a state space which describes a composite system or history in this case. And then I showed that the Hayton algebra of a subobject, so the tensor product Hayton algebras of the various subobjects at different times, is actually homomorphic to the subobject of the state space which represent the composite system. So that now we can physically identify history proposition as an element of this, of the subobjects of the state space of a composite system. So it somehow acquires a physical meaning in this way. As an element of that, it was just purely an algebraic way of describing it. But now that you embedded as an element of the state space of the composite system, it actually becomes meaningful. Yeah.
Offers some canonical or? I mean, is it a unique way, or are there many ways?
Oh, I put just for one, I don't know.
For the theorem.
Yeah, I don't know, I just made up a map that defines that.
Okay, but you don't know if that map is unique?
No, I didn't put that.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a much dumber question, simple question. So embedded in this, you're realizing this, which you call temporal logic, that the direct product somehow implements the notion of and then this happened and then that happened. If I had just two quantum systems, I would have just the notion of combining them as a product, and then I have some notion of and, but not and then. So is there a simple way to say how what you would do to implement and just define two systems differs from and then?
To implement and, then you would just need one topos. And that's just the Hayton algebra. I mean, since there is no temporality, for the same system, you just have one time over space. And within this, so you take away that, within the subobjects are only one Hilbert space, then you have a Hayton algebra and your AND is defined. If you take two different systems, then it's the same as you get here, since they're two.
So I guess that's what I'm asking. If I have an electron and a proton, then is it the same structure as an electron now and an electron in 10 minutes?
No. You wouldn't have this temporal structure now.
Right, so is there a simple way to, I've just lost the thread, and you can just rule me as ignorant, but is there a simple way to say how the temporal, maybe this just requires going back, what is the key to how a temporal structure differs from
this? I mean, here you have to see it as A1 or B1 at time T1, and then A2 or B2. if this you had and, this would be distributed, and this thing would be actually equal to that if this were as and.
I think Lee's question is more like,
I think that's the answer.
Because it's temporal, this is, it's bigger than this. Because, I mean, just if you say the sentence, this or this, and then that or that, it's like saying A1 and then A2, or A1 and then B2, or B1 and then A2. So the various possibilities.
Ah, okay.
Which you wouldn't if you just had and.
Okay, thank you.
But why wouldn't you have that with just and? I mean, if I have A1 or B1 and A2 or B2, then it seems to me one of the possibilities would be A1 and B2. It's just usually and does distribute over more in classical logic. So the first equality would also hold under an interpretation of the tensor product as and.
Mm-hmm. But then this...
If you consider them to be like, say the A's to be on some Hilbert space, then and the, like what Lee is suggesting, that they're spatial, right? So the A's would be considered one Hilbert space just tensored with the other one. So if you have A1 on the first Hilbert space and A2 on the other Hilbert space, which is somewhere different spatially, then you get the final thing.
You have to convince me that A1 here and B2 there is ruled out. And I haven't seen that yet. Why?
You need to have something in A, right? Because they need to exist at the same time. If they're temporal, they don't need to exist.
Yeah, but if A1 and A. So if you say over here it has to be A1 or B1, and over here it has to be A2 or B2.
But that's the point, is that over here it can only be A, because A are the ones of the...
Oh, I see. I see. So A, I see. Okay. Okay, let me think about this.
Can I ask something that I think that was related to Lee's question? I thought it was Lee's question, but maybe it wasn't. But there's a question of why is this a temporal? I mean, I think you're getting it. Why is this a temporal disjunction, or why is this a temporal composition of two different objects as opposed to just some general composition? It could be simultaneous, or it could have nothing to do with time. So that might show up in two ways. If there was a difference between capital A and then capital B, if that was different from capital B and then capital A, or it might show up if you put three, an A and then B and then C was different from, for example, A and then C and then B. In other words, a different arrangement of A, B, and C.
I mean, this label here is time label.
So right.
It has to be a sequence.
But does the sequence play a role? So if I had a C, if I put A and then B and then C, would that be any different from A and then C and then B? In other words, in one case, B is in between A and C, and in the other case, C is in between A and B.
Okay.
Would that define different kinds of algebras?
Okay, from pure logical, no, but then you require, I mean, the time label goes on the elements.
Right.
So you could not interchange it.
Right, but is the label playing some role in the physics? I guess that's the question.
Okay. It does. It would represent discrete time steps.
Because time is running out, and you're talking a lot more. I apologize for interrupting.
Okay. Now, although as what I did so far is follow the kind of logical rules. So you had. for positions at different times, which belong to Hayton algebra at different times, you group them together to give a temporal structure, and you obtain this proposition as an element of the subobject of this state space. However, if you go another route, so that if you take the tensor product directly itself as a projection, so you forget about the temporal dependence on the individual time components, and you apply the same machinery, you arrive to a different topos, which is actually quite different since the category of algebras of tensor of Hilbert space is quite different from the cross product. For example, you have entangled contexts and other contexts. So what is the relation between these two topoi and in particular these two propositions? And again, you can define a relation in terms of a relation between the context categories, like so. And again, you pull back the sheaf, so map from your set, you pull it back. And you see that, so you obtain this relation. And you see that the state space of this object, if you pull it back to the state space of this object, it coincided with the composite state space coming from the two different times. So that for pure tensor product, these two topoi coincide and the state spaces coincide. So now this is, I mean, it's kind of puzzling in the sense that as long as the logic is concerned, you can define both homogeneous and inhomogeneous propositions in terms of this intermediate topos, and you can play around with this temporal logic, and I mean, it suffices to define anything that you want about homogeneous and inhomogeneous history propositions. However, if you forget about the temporal structure of your history proposition, so if you forget about the direct dependence of your history proposition to the individual times, and you just consider as a projection operator, you get to this full topos. And this full topos has different types of contexts, which by considering them, you can still define history propositions and you can define everything, but you lose the dependence of your history proposition on the individual time components. All right, then just briefly. Another claim made was that the truth values of history proposition can be given in terms of the truth values of the individual time components. And again, it's like before. I mean, we've seen from the when I described the topos definition of the quantum theory that the truth values, again, are Hayton algebras. So you can define the tensor product of this Hayton algebras. Again, in order to give them physical significance, you have to embed them in a topos. In the sense that they have to be elements on a topos. So you pull everything back to intermediate topos again. And then I showed that the two Hayton algebras again coincide. So what this theorem says is basically that the truth value of your history proposition is given in terms of the truth values of the single time propositions. So again, even for the truth values, you can define stuff in the intermediate topos, but in such a way that there's a clear dependence between the truth value of your proposition and the single time truth values. However, for the full topos, in which there are more than just pure tensor product categories, this strict dependence is lost. Okay, so summary. What I started off was to try and define a topos version of the logical aspect of the HPO formalism, and I did this by extending the formalism of defined by Eichmann and Doring to the context of history theories. And by doing that and by following the logical route, in the sense that a history proposition is really seen as a temporal proposition, I reached the definition of history as an element of the Hayton algebra that belongs to the intermediate topos. However, if we just consider history proposition as an element in itself, not as a temporal position, you obtain this more complicated topos. And for non-entangled context, the two topos coincide. Now, a very important kind of research that I'm doing now is really to try and define, even for entangled context, how, if it's possible to still represent history propositions as temporal connected propositions. And that's not completely impossible, since, I mean, for an entangled context, that is something like this. And this is a commutative algebra, which means that these two algebras commute. So somehow it is actually possible to embed this algebra in something bigger, which is actually a pure tensor product algebra. So I think in this way, I mean, this, I've still not done this, this is just work in progress, but I think somehow in this way, then you can retrieve the logical dependence of history proposition even for entangled contexts. But this is something that I haven't done at the moment. And so the aim would be something to define, I don't know, maybe a quantum tensor product so that the subobjects at different times actually as a morphing to the subobject of the spectral for sheaf of the two topos. I mean, if you don't do the quantum tensor problem, then you get the intermediate topos. But maybe there's some other mathematical construct which would enable you to define such an isomorphism. But this, okay, this I haven't really done yet. Okay, then another way or another future work would be to extend it to continuous time, because up to now I just considered a discrete set of time points. But maybe you could define it in terms of continuous time and then extend this to a quantum field theory. But I mean, these are all just ideas of possible extensions, but I haven't done yet. That's it.
Further questions? There any?
So in the one-time formalism that you started with, so there's a culmination of it all, or more or less the last thing you said before you went on to the history's formalism, was this, you start with a vector in Hilbert space and from it you get, I don't remember the word that you gave to it.
A pseudo-state,
okay. You get a pseudo-state. So if we're in a history's formalism, then there's not just one vector, or is there? I mean, there's the issue of how the dynamics gets in. So what plays the role of pseudo-state in the...
That's a good question. So you would obtain is the same mechanism that I use for proposition. So you have a state psi at time t1, and then state psi at time t2. Then again, you know that this is identified with a pseudo state at time t1, which is a subobject of the state space. So it's an element of a Hayton algebra. And this is a pseudo state at time t2, another element of Hayton algebra. Therefore, you can actually define the tensor product, which is an element of the tensor product Hayton algebra. And so this would be the end. This would be the pseudo state of the composite. So it's like you did for proposition. It's because,
so you're just allowing yourself to specify freely the state at time t1 and the state at time t2.
This is the evolution of the state.
Right, so the rules for the evolution are not built into this framework somehow. They come from outside,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's pretty clear from what you said that your motivation for following the topos formulation at a single time is to try to achieve a realist interpretation of quantum mechanics. But I didn't hear what the motivation was for following a histories approach, as opposed to, say, just saying, well, we have states defined by the Stokes formulation, and they evolve over time dynamically, and that's my realism interpretation. Mm-hmm. So what motivated you to apply this to a histories approach?
Oh, because of the H pure formulas. And I mean, yeah, sure, I could. All this could also be true just for composition, composite systems. The reason I used the HPO for the history is just it is in order to give a time evolution, but in such a way that the time evolution is encoded in different projections at different times. And that's what the history proposition is in the HPO formulas. So in order to apply this topos machinery, you need as main quantities the projection operators because of this dozenization map. I mean, it's really this dozenization map that enables you to identify projections with subobjects of the spectrum of the state space.
Maybe I'm not making it clear what the question is. So I guess I'm sort of wondering why you're attracted to the HPO formalism to begin with, as opposed to being happy with just a regular kind of picture, whereas you have states at a single time which evolve dynamically. So you could say, all right, we have this topos formulation now at a single time. I'm happy with that because it gives me realism. And now what do I say about the history of the universe? Well, it's just a dynamical state and it evolves. So presumably you're not happy with that. And my question is, why?
I don't know. Well, that is actually, I mean, when I said that I go through the logical route in the sense that I start with the history and I consider how you, the toposification of the history at different times, and then I put them together in a temporal, in a logical structure. That's what I do, and that's when you get this intermediate topos. However, if you start with the HPO formulas, then you get another topos. So I did at the start when I said here that I wanted to. The technique is exactly what you were saying. You get to different times, you define the topos version at different times, and then you join them together.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do that, then you get a different result than if you consider the HPO formulation from the start. So
you get two different theories, depending on what approach you take?
You end up with two different topos, which coincide only if the context are pure tensor products in this case here. So you go different routes. You go through the route of just temporal evolution or the HPO route. And actually, so they would have the same thing.
And so what makes you confident that the HPO route is the right way to go? It gives a different answer.
Well, because it contains an this is a well-established history, but no, it does contain entangled context. It just, the thing that by going through the logical route, you somehow just capture the logic of a history formalism. By going to the other route, you even capture the physics in the sense that you get entangled context.
Yeah, so just a simple question, what is an entangled context?
Oh, it's an algebra that's like this, which is not pure tensor form algebra. That's what I define.
So does it physically mean like combining questions or measurements, if you like, at different times? Is that what's the physical significance of the entanglement? What could you think of a kind of measurement or a kind of question you could ask that would only belong to the entangled context? And not to the unentangled context.
Well, for example, the projection operator on a Bell state that you can only have this entangled context.
Okay, thank you.